is this high school still around?
Oh, yeah.
Is it?
Yep.
All right, Keith Ellison and Jeff Pilsick, you got to say hi to both of them.
I promise you I will.
Every time Jeff calls.
Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Bratfold, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Good morning, counsel. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, January 9th, 2020. This is our first oral calendar of the new year. Happy New Year to both of you. Thank you. And the first case on our calendar, we have six cases on our calendar for today. Four are set for oral argument, the first of which is A19-1190. John Dennis, is it LaRoque?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Versus the Commissioner of Public Safety. As you both know, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, and counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. When you approach the podium, feel free to raise it or lower it. There's a button underneath that you can do that. And also state your name for the record and the party you're representing. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and Happy New Year to all three of you. My name is Steve Meshbesher, and I represent the appellant, John Dennis LaRoque. To simplify matters, in my brief to the Court of Appeals, I made it in a one-sentence issue. As a matter of law, he was not in physical control of a motor vehicle. And I take the proven facts testified in court in front of Judge Stevenson in Ramsey County as a basis to make that question. The police did not see him in the vehicle. They never saw him drive the vehicle. They never found the keys of the vehicle on him. He was outside the motor vehicle. And they based their decision, supposedly, on him saying, while he was highly intoxicated, that he attempted to stop the vehicle. Now, what they didn't know is what I show is you cannot switch gears the vehicle with a clutch because there is no clutch.
What's the difference between a clutch and a gear?
A clutch.
Let me rephrase the question. Is there really much of a substantive difference between a clutch and a gear in the sense that one is to control an automatic car versus one that is a stick shift?
Well, I'm 65 years old, and I grew up with clutches. And a clutch in my younger days would be where there were three pedals. There was the gas pedal, the brake pedal, and over here was the clutch pedal where you put your foot on it.
Right, here we've got an automatic.
There is no clutch.
Right. So what's the equivalent of a clutch in an automatic car?
They're saying there was a clutch. There is no equivalent. They're misstating the fact. The fact doesn't exist.
No, it's not a misstatement of the fact because that's what he claimed he grabbed, correct? That's what he told the officer.
Allegedly.
I'm not so sure it's allegedly. That's what the officer testified to. That's what he told, that appellant told the officer he grabbed the clutch to change the gears.
And What my client was is three times over the legal limit, and he was highly intoxicated. In a lot of my other cases, we take people who are that intoxicated and we don't give them the fair weight of the law and the accuracy of the law because they're so intoxicated. So now we're being asked to believe what he says as opposed to disbelieve what he says.
Well, that's a credibility determination that we give great deference to the district court to.
The district court's just wrong in the way they give credibility to a fact that doesn't exist. There is no clutch.
Is there any value or importance to in the findings where clutch is in quotes? Does that shed any light on kind of where the district court might have been in saying whatever he meant by clutch, he said the word clutch. We don't know what he meant when he said that. And they're giving credit to the trooper when the judge is saying that that's what he told the trooper. They have to assume that what the trooper is telling the court is true. And I think that's the finding, the first part of the finding, is that they are crediting the trooper's testimony about what the trooper says was said to him by defendant. Well, the second part, and my question's more about, do you make anything of the quotation marks around the word clutch? And is it improper for the district court to have found whatever was meant by that word, he meant something on the car, whatever was meant by that word, he, in the words of the district court, caused the car to stop by grabbing whatever that thing is.
Well, that's interesting. And they're not saying, nobody says he caused the car to stop.
So, counsel, I'll draw your attention to where the district court says that your client caused the car to stop. So it's in conclusion of law number 6, which we often find do include findings of fact, and that happens to be true here, and where the district court says petitioner admitted to Trooper Lesser at the scene of the incident that he had changed the gear of the car while Ms. Gordon was driving, which at one point caused the car to stop moving.
And if I could jump also, findings of fact.
Judge Ryan's referring.
Findings of fact 10 is also where the court is making a finding about what Trooper Lesser is reporting. And it's in that statement that there's only one word in quotation marks, the word clutch, and it says cause the car to stop by grabbing the clutch. So I think there is a finding both that he said something to the trooper and there's a finding that what he said to the trooper was it caused the car to stop. So my question is, does it matter? Do you make any... Is there any importance to the quotation marks around clutch?
Yes, because there is no evidence to support it. The whole purpose of this appeal and the reason we've appealed it is there's no evidence to support it.
To support what?
The judge's conclusion.
That he grabbed a clutch because no clutch existed? That's
yes.
What I hear to be your argument.
There's no evidence. There was no evidence to support it. Now, there was another issue. Mm-hmm. There was another witness. And the state's attorney never brought that other witness in. So they're trying to use hearsay or double hearsay.
Well, before we get to that, I want to ask, kind of go back to the initial question, because I do think there's a distinction between the finding in paragraph 10, mm-hmm. the finding of fact with clutch and quotation marks, and the conclusion of law that says change the gear of the car, cause the car to stop moving. And the judge does not use the word clutch either in quotes or without in the conclusion. So I think that there is potentially, and I'm asking what you think, what you make of that, is it possible that the court, this impossibility of grabbing the clutch because the car doesn't have a clutch, that the court still gave importance to that statement and inferred that he must have grabbed something, whether it was a clutch or something that he's referring to as a clutch, he grabbed something, and whatever the thing was, that caused the car to stop, and is that improper for the court to do? Because that's, as I see it, the question before us on the physical control issue.
Well, the question before, that is a good question. Mm-hmm. And also the question before this court is who's this other witness that the state forgot to bring in and have them testify?
Well, does that really matter? All that matters are the findings of fact and conclusions of the law that are in front of us.
Well, they have to have findings of fact based upon a fair preponderance of the evidence, and there's no evidence.
And here, to I have the same concern that Judge Bryan has. When it talks about grabbing the clutch in quotes, in my mind, it doesn't really matter what you call it. Something was grabbed, and the next phrase of that sentence, I think, is really the key part of the finding of fact, and changing the gears of the car. So whether it's some type of control mechanism that's on the steering wheel or control mechanism that's down where the traditional stick shift was, but even exists in automatic cars, the fact of the matter is there's a finding that he grabbed something that he referred to as a clutch that changed the gears of the car. The gears of the car are to have it either in drive, neutral, reverse, and it doesn't really matter. I know you made the argument that you can only change it when it's in brake, but when you're in drive, you can change drive into neutral.
But there's no evidence.
You can drive it into reverse, and you can leave your tranny a mile back behind you, but you can you don't have to put the brake on to change it. So I think that argument is to the side. But the fact of the matter is the finding is that he grabbed something that he called a clutch to change the gears of the car. That seems to be pretty solid evidence of him having physical control of the car as it's defined in Minnesota.
If there was evidence to prove that, but there's not. There's no evidence of it.
The evidence is the testimony from the officer.
The officer didn't see it. He wasn't there.
You don't have to have direct evidence. You can have circumstantial evidence.
He's going on hearsay evidence of the gal who was actually driving the car?
No, what appellant told the officer.
Appellant didn't say that he got on the witness stand and said he didn't touch the car.
That's his testimony at trial. That's different than what he said at the time of the incident.
Well, at the time of the incident, the officer didn't say that. The officer said that he attempted to.
He attempted to what?
To grab the keys or grab the clutch. He didn't actually grab anything, and he didn't cause the car to stop.
He said
my client didn't tell the.
This is what the finding of fact is. Petitioner told Trooper Lesser that while Miss Gordon was driving, he tried to grab the keys.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the attempt part. He attempted to grab the keys, whether it's successful or not. That in my mind is different than the second part where it says, and also caused the car to stop. That's not an attempt. That's something he actually caused.
But there's no factual basis proven in the courtroom by any evidence that he caused the car to stop.
Well,
there's no witnesses to it, and they could have called. The main witness would have been the gal who was driving the car, and they forgot to call her as a witness. And so there's no evidence of it other than his own words. So they're using his own words, and he's making a conclusion, a legal conclusion based on his own words, where there's no evidence of it.
The evidence of it is his statement to the police officer.
And is that it? His own statement? That's the only evidence? A guy who's extraordinarily intoxicated?
So those were all arguments that were made at the hearing to the district court judge. It was pointed out how, isn't it three times the legal limit?
Yes.
That your client was trying, and that was not disputed at the hearing. This physical control was the only issue.
Yes.
And that was argued to the district court judge. Well, he was so intoxicated, did he really know what he was saying? The judge made his finding.
And I'm
so our only issue is whether that finding is supported by the evidence. And as Judge Reyes pointed out, you know, we've got this testimony from the trooper about Mr. LaRoque's statements. And as a defendant, you know, those statements are evidence.
But they're not reliable. It's not reliable evidence.
I made that argument. That determination of reliability, credibility, weight of the evidence, it all goes to the district court judge, not to this court. We don't second-guess those determinations.
There was nothing physical to support what he said. They never saw him in the car. They never saw the keys on his person. He was walking on the side of a road. The prosecutor on the criminal side of the case dismissed the DWIs. I know that doesn't have anything to do with today, but they dismissed it. They didn't think there was evidence they could prove of him having physical control, so they dismissed the criminal prosecution. The evidence at the implied consent hearing is the same, different standard of proof. The standard of proof is a fair preponderance, and he's not presumed innocent. I've read the judge's order. I know you don't want to second guess what he wrote, but I'm asking you to look at the facts. And the facts are the officers are trying to sustain the revocation predicated on what he said, not what they saw. They didn't see anything. And they're going on, and then they make reference to another witness who never testified. They could have called her as a witness and asked her what she saw and what happened, but they never did. So they all they have is his testimony as to what he allegedly said. It wasn't recorded. They have they could use body cameras. They could have had it recorded, but they didn't. They asked him to say something. It wasn't recorded. We don't know exactly what he said. And he is a former police officer, and he got on the witness stand, and he testified. He talked about how many DWI arrests he had made and that he knew the difference between driving under the influence, operating, or physical control, because he's made a number of arrests himself. And he was never in physical control. Physical control is dominion or control. He never had dominion or control.
So, counsel, here's something. I see your time is almost up, and so I don't want to push you on this at this point, but if you have some time during your rebuttal, one of the arguments made in the state's brief that you didn't file a reply, so I don't know what your thinking is on it, has to do not with physical control, including interference with driving, and the Henderson case, as well as I think there's a second case cited in Henderson. And the state relies on that. So I'd appreciate, because in my opinion, those cases suggest that, you know, physical control can be shown by interference that affects the movement of the vehicle. So maybe you'll talk about that on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the state.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Leah Hedman. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm here on behalf of the Commissioner of Public Safety, respondent in this matter. Your Honors, I was listening carefully to the questions you posed to Mr. Meshbesher, and you're really hitting the nail right on the head here. Specifically, this case turns on a single credibility determination made by the district court, and that is the district court chose to believe appellate statements made to the trooper at the scene over his statements months later at the hearing. And it was that determination that really led to the findings of fact and conclusions of law that you've honed in on. The key findings, as you noted, are finding number 10, as well as conclusion of law number 6, which we think is probably more of in line with the finding itself. And then the key conclusion is number 8. So specifically, finding 10 is that petitioner told Trooper Lesser that while Miss Gordon was driving, he tried to grab the keys and also caused the car to stop by grabbing the clutch, in quotations, and changing the gears of the car. And you've really honed in exactly where I was hoping that you would be, and that is that by changing the gears of the car and causing the car to stop, you meet the standard of physical control. We know that physical control means a person's in a position to exercise dominion or control over a vehicle and has the means to initiate any movement of the vehicle and is in close proximity to the operating controls of the vehicle. That's conclusion of law number 4. It's citing the State v. Woodward case. And here we know that because he was changing the gears, by his own admission at the scene, appellant confirms that he was changing the gears. And the reason that we find that to be not hearsay is because it's a party admission by a party opponent. So it's allowed because at the scene, at the time, there's no time to develop a new story or come up with a new version of events. He's sort of in the raw emotion of seeing the trooper, and he's providing that information. And one must wonder, as the district court must have wondered here, why else would he make those statements but for them being the truth? Why else would you claim to be changing the gears? And he admits so much, but those are really the, I think if you just focus on changing the gears and stopping the car, that in and of itself meets that definition of physical control. But he's saying he's doing much more, right? He's being pretty truthful. I didn't want to go to Duluth. I wanted to go to Shoreview. She was making me go to Duluth. I grabbed her. He admitted he grabbed his stepdaughter. She was driving down the road. That's in page 10 of the transcript. He admitted that he was trying to grab or manipulate the clutch multiple times. Again, that finds evidentiary support in pages 10 and 11 of the transcript. He admits that he was trying to change.
I think what I hear the appellant arguing is that what we have in part are, at least on the face of it, findings of fact by the district court that don't match the evidence as to what equipment was in this vehicle. So we do have a statement. I mean, as you just said, our district court judge credited the statement of the trooper about what the defendant said at the scene, that he grabbed the clutch. But we have a car in which, we have a vehicle in which there is no clutch, right?
Right.
So how do you respond to that?
Thank you, Your Honor. As you alluded to, actually, in your question to him earlier.
I'm just asking questions.
Yeah,
I'm not as good as the evidence. So I need you to focus on how do we reason this from the evidence in the record.
Thank you, yes. So clutch was a word that was supplied by appellant himself. And granted, he was over the legal limit clearly here a number of times over. But his version of seeing the clutch, he also said he changed the gears and he admitted to stopping the car. And so clutch or no clutch doesn't really matter if you're able to change the gears. Then you're able to exercise dominion and control over that minivan as it traveled down Interstate 35.
Is there some limitation to the court crediting the statements made on the scene? In other words, in this case, what Appellant is arguing is that it's an impossibility for him to have grabbed the clutch because the clutch doesn't exist. Is there some, but the court finds otherwise. And so my question is there some limitation to what credit the court can give a defendant's statement on the scene?
I don't think so, because it ultimately it's the credibility determination. And of course, that's most properly put in the hands of the district court because they're able to see the demeanor of the witnesses, et cetera. So I don't think they have to sort of hold back. I think they look at the totality of the circumstances properly, and I think Judge Stevenson, the district court here, did that. while there was information provided about what the daughter had said, the judge, the district court, chose not to rely on that. Instead, he artfully crafted his order, focusing only on appellant's own statements to the trooper at the scene. And that's the basis for that finding 10, as well as conclusion 6 and then 7 and 8.
I recall, the daughter's statements, stepdaughter, I think, Ms. Gordon, her statements did get into the record in this case. There was an objection about her that being hearsay because she wasn't a witness. But I think it was elicited, perhaps, on cross. Is that right?
It's exactly right. So although objected when the attorney representing the commissioner tried to elicit testimony as to that, Mr. Meshbusher, representing the petitioner, now appellant, did ask some questions, and that's how the testimony got in. It was on cross. But the judge here, the district court, really doesn't even rely upon that. He avoids the hearsay issue and instead focuses on appellant's own words. And because appellant is speaking to the trooper in the moment at the time. Later, his testimony changed at the hearing, as sometimes will happen. He says, oh, my stepdaughter and I were having a discussion as they, you know, just doesn't seem credible. She's running down the side of the interstate, on the shoulder of the interstate, in the wrong direction of traffic to get away from him, and he's running after her. It was more than a discussion. The judge made the correct credibility determinations here, looked at the totality of the circumstances, and said, you changed the gears of that car. He was intentionally taking action to affect the movement of this vehicle. He did not want to go to Duluth, and he was going to do anything he could to avoid doing it. And he was able to stop the motor vehicle. That, in and of itself, is enough for this court to find physical control. And with regard to one more issue that's just sort of a side issue, at one point there was discussion at the original argument with regard to the plea of guilty. I would point you to page 2 of appellant's brief, which indicates that appellant pled guilty to the charge of disorderly conduct with the remaining criminal charges dismissed. So there isn't any basis for this court to find what the prosecutor's thinking was in terms of why those were dismissed or why a plea arrangement was taken. I think that's outside the scope of this hearing before you. Here, the district court made a credibility determination that is rooted in the evidence, and that's found at transcript pages 10 and 11, as well as 19 through 21. So those are the specific places in the transcript where the district court would find evidentiary support for the findings and conclusions that he made and were appropriate here. Your Honors, I would close my comments unless you have further questions of me.
Well, I wanted to ask you the question I asked appellant's counsel, which has to do with your citation of the Henderson case, which I read to be talking more about interference than, you know, obviously physical control includes a lot of things. We've already talked about that definition, dominion. Or control of the vehicle. So it could be stopping the vehicle, but it could be taking an action that otherwise affects the movement of the vehicle. So was that your purpose in relying on Henderson, or am I misconstruing that?
No. Henderson is sort of twofold, right? We have the Court of Appeals decision that was affirmed by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court case, that's 907 Northwest 2nd 623. It's a 2018 decision. And it states, and this is under the criminal vehicle operation statute.
Right, it's not a DWI or an implied consent case.
Thank you so much, yes. And they say, here, a reading of the criminal vehicular operation statute as a whole supports only one reasonable interpretation of operating, which includes manipulation of the steering wheel of a moving vehicle by a passenger. And we have that here because it's the operating controls and changing the gears and stopping a vehicle would be in that same interference by a passenger. You don't have to be in the driver's seat or the driver in the actual sort of sense that most people would think of in order to do that.
Right, and as I understand it, you wouldn't even have to be the person who put your foot on the passenger who is charged with having dominion or control over the vehicle. Would not even have to be the one who places their foot on the pedal if they led the driver to take conduct, you know, some sort of behavior that affected the influence or influenced the movement of the vehicle.
Yes, I think I understand where you're going. Yeah. Yes, and that is that even if she had control over the brake pedal at the whole time, she's not able to adequately drive her minivan if, in fact, someone else is changing the gears. That's affecting her ability to drive the minivan, and it's affecting the operation, most importantly, of the minivan and causing it to stop by changing the gears. And that's enough for physical control within the definition.
You know, as I agree with you, our judge did not credit the hearsay that was admitted, received as to the stepdaughter's statements. But her statements, if you look at them alone, do suggest more of interference on Mr. LaRoque's part as opposed to actually physically stopping the vehicle.
Well, I think so, and I think it's really akin to Henderson if you credit her statements. She says he pulled the steering wheel, and he caused that vehicle to turn to the shoulder, and that's exactly the conduct in the Henderson case.
Is it even appropriate for us to consider that, though, if it's not part of the district court's findings of fact?
I was trying to avoid that, actually, but
yeah.
I think it's right to focus just on his own. I think appellant sort of knits his own noose with his statements at the at the scene. You know, he's made his bed because of his statements and admissions against his own interests to the trooper at the scene, credited properly by the trial court, and it's that I think supplies the evidentiary basis for those findings and conclusions.
So if I could follow up to the district court cites to State v. Woodward in conclusion 4,
And the part of the definition of physical control that I want to ask about is the part of the definition listed there where a person is in a position to exercise dominion or control or is in close proximity to the operating controls, because it seems to me that the court in Shane takes a slightly more narrow view of things. If there's a person in the passenger seat who's able to press the gas pedal, as we have in Shane, that to me would fit the definition of physical control under Woodard or Woodward. So what is your position today about whether Shane limits or narrows or controls instead of Woodward?
Thank you for the question. I actually had the same question when I was going through this. What was the difference about Shane? When I looked at Shane, I noticed that it was January 28th, 1997. Because of that, I think that that was the only reason why the officers in Shane kept that passenger in the running motor vehicle as they invited the driver out for additional investigation. Otherwise, I don't think that a passenger who's inebriated, such as Shane was, would be left in an operating motor vehicle. I think it was probably pretty bitter, and I think they were trying to keep him in a warm situation. He was not trying to shift anything.
The definition in Woodward is in a position to do so or able to operate in proximity to the operating controls, and it goes to more of this attempt argument. And so that's why I asked the question.
Yeah, so
is the act of attempting to grab the keys enough because it puts someone in close proximity under Woodward? But on the other hand, Shane would suggest that Woodward is too broad today.
Your Honor, I apologize. I started my answer a little early there. I thought you were
no problem. Go ahead.
Sorry. I think Shane is different because it felt like the police were kind of doing a gotcha. They were trying to get a twofer. They had the driver already that they were investigating, and then this passenger revs the engine, possibly to warm the vehicle, and they're like, well, that's enough. You're in physical control. It seemed to me like that was what was going on. I'll just tell you my off-the-cuff read of Shane was that they didn't really want to encourage police to do it. If you're really trying to effectuate the movement of the car, and here our facts are so different.
Again, I'm asking about what the legal definition is apart from the facts, and it seems to me that being able to access the gas pedal would fit under the Woodward definition, and yet the Supreme Court, or is it the Supreme Court in Shane? I think it is. Shane finds that that's not physical control. So the question is, what is after Shane? What are we left with in terms of the definition of physical control?
So I think one of the key parts of Shane is that totality of the circumstances, and that's why I was saying that it felt like the police were kind of running a gotcha on the passenger there. This is a passenger, a situation where, A, I don't think you need to reach that because the facts are so much clearer in the case before you. He's changing the gears and he's stopping the vehicle. And again, I think that's enough in and of itself by his own statements to find him in physical control. I think the district court is right. But in terms of answering your question more completely, Shane feels, again, it had sort of a distaste reading it, that it seemed like they were trying to get a twofer and trying to get this passenger who may have been trying to stay warm on January 28th, as opposed to really trying to effectuate change, moving that vehicle. If you're in the passenger seat, which apparently this Shane was, it wouldn't make sense really to try to operate the vehicle. You'd slide over and then get in the driver's seat if you were really going to proceed forward, one would think. So I think in the totality of the circumstances, I don't want to second guess all the judges there, but that was my read of what makes it different. Looking at Woodward, it does. You're correct in your read of Woodward, as is the district court in conclusion of law number 4, where he gives the definition. But this also has to do with that. It's the Wooden case, which this court did as an unpublished case, Warden, W-O-R-D-E-N, from 1997. And that case said that the subsequent shifting of the gears and stepping on the gas pedal constitutes physical control. And the fact that they were an appellant was a passenger does not absolve her where she affirmatively took steps to control the vehicle. And I think even though this is an unpublished case and you know the treatment to give that, I think that here we have a situation where appellant affirmatively took steps to control the vehicle. And that may be the nuance provides the disparity between the finding in Shane as well as the finding in the other cases, Woodward and Warden here. Your Honors, that would close my comments. I would ask that you affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes.
The one clarification I would like to make is the judge did not say, or the evidence did not show that he changed or touched a clutch that didn't exist, but that he attempted to. The word attempt is in there because in cross-examination of the officer, initially on direct examination, and you have the transcript, he said that my client admitted to him that he touched the clutch that didn't exist. When I cross-examined the officer, he said that my client told him he attempted to.
Counsel, what was it on the scene that the defendant, that Mr. LaRocque said caused the car to stop?
He didn't. He never answered that. They never asked him that. The other witness, who they never called, may have answered that. I don't know. But they never called her as a witness. So my client never answered that because the question was never asked of him. What the officer did on cross-examination by me is admit that my client said to him that he attempted to do it. So there was a difference between the direct examination and the cross-examination. On the direct, he says, my client told him he touched it. And I'm talking about the impossibility of touching something that doesn't exist. On cross-examination, he says he testified that he attempted to. But before, I just wanted to point that out.
But that goes down to credibility of which testimony the court believed.
Well, but that's an examination of the state's witness. That's not about credibility of my client. It's credibility of the state's witness. Right. And he said two things. And the judge didn't talk about the credibility of the state's witness or disregard one over the other. I cross-examined him, and he admitted under oath that my client told him it was an attempt, not a completed act. So,
but you said he said two things, and the district court is free to believe one testimony over the other,
sure,
and believe that he actually grabbed it rather than just attempted to
grab it. He doesn't say that.
Who doesn't say that?
The judge doesn't say the differences between his testimony on direct and cross, and he doesn't say I'm choosing one or the other.
Why does that matter? The district court in its findings says what it found to be true, that the petitioner told Trooper Lesser that while Ms. Gordon was driving, he tried to grab the keys, so that's the attempt part, and then it says, and then also caused the car to stop by grabbing the quote-unquote clutch and changing the gears of the car.
It matters because on cross-examination, I asked him the question, the trooper, and he said it was an attempt, not a completed act. So it matters because that's what he said on the record, and the judge never responded to it. And it matters because the standard up here is clearly erroneous. But before I go further, I would like to go to Justice Bratvold and ask her to tell me again what that issue was that we were going to discuss on.
If you feel like you've had a chance to answer Judge Arias' question.
I'm doing the best I can. I think I've taken it as far as I can take.
No, what I was hoping that you'd address is the final, and I asked a line of questions of the state's attorney with regard to the Henderson case, and that has to do with whether interference, a passenger's interference with the driver, which leads to a change in movement of the vehicle, is that enough? Now, Henderson is a CVO case. It's not a DWI case, but it actually relies on an implied consent case for a very specific finding. The Ives, all of this was cited in the state's brief, so I just assume you probably read it recently or would just know it because you've been practicing law a long time. So our court has said previously that a drunk passenger who interferes with the safe operation of a motor vehicle by actively tampering with its controls poses no less of a hazard to the public safety than any other drunk driver. That's a case where the passenger, I believe, stepped on the accelerator from the passenger seat. You know, the specific facts don't matter. The question is legally the interference with the driver.
Well, it's a good question, and that's exactly what
I think it gets to your argument about attempt. I mean, if we are dealing with a situation where where Mr. LaRoque is merely attempting something, if that attempt results in interference, isn't that enough?
Well, if the attempt, but the judge doesn't say that. That's why I'm on appeal on a clearly erroneous standard, because he doesn't say that, and I'm frustrated with what he doesn't say, not what he does say. And the testimony of cross-examination versus the testimony of direct examination has a little contradiction, but he doesn't, it's not that he says, I believe this officer. What part of it do you believe? And what part of it do you not believe? And why do you disbelieve one cross-examination? Under oath, he says something else. And so the appeal is based on a clearly erroneous standard. Thank you.
Thank you both, counsel, for the oral arguments. Very well done. We always appreciate the clarity that you provide in the oral arguments. We will be taking the issue under advisement and issue an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you both. Our next case on the calendar is A19-0451, State of Minnesota versus Carrie Lynn Freese.